Davison Opter here with Matt Ford and Jonathan Harding. An underwhelming finish for the German national team in 2018 after a 2-2 draw with the Netherlands. We are also going to spotlight Hertha Berlin in this week's podcast. But first, let's start with the action from Gelsenkirchen. So, Germany's very trying year in 2018 came to an underwhelming end after a 2-2 draw with the Netherlands. They did also beat Russia in a friendly 3-0 in Leipzig. But Jonathan, you were there in Gelsenkirchen for the game last night. You were saying before that you had a piece all ready to write when they were 2-0 up in the 80th minute.
I did.
And then had to throw it out. So what were your thoughts on the game and the way that, especially the way that it finished?
Well, the way that it finished was really poor from Germany's perspective and very typical of the year that they've had. They collapsed under foreseeable and predictable Dutch pressure. And this came from a Dutch side that had been pretty lethargic for most of the game. And that's what's so disappointing. Löw's decision to play five at the back, I thought, worked really well for the most part. Two wing backs, they had three in the centre with Zulu, Rudiger and Hummels. It was very solid. They dealt with most of the Dutch pace really well. Individual battles were won. They looked fairly comfortable and controlled after a really dominant first half. That was what's so impressive. Those three players going forward, Sané, Gnabry and Werner, they were really excellent. And that's what this whole game feels like, because actually everyone's talking about the fact that it was a draw that felt like a loss and that was disappointing. And yet the overriding image of the night was how positive that they were going forward. And that's something we haven't really seen from them in the last 6 months. But that is lost now because of the way that the game finished and they threw it away. And I think that's what's so frustrating from Germany's perspective. This was an opportunity to finish the year showing everybody, particularly for Löw, which is the most important part, we're going in the right direction. I've recognized that these young players up top are the future of this team. There are still a few things we need to work out, but we're moving forward. And yet you left the stadium, and James Thorogood, a good friend of ours and colleague of ours, said this and thought it was the perfect way to put it. You left the stadium still thinking about Russia. And I think that's the problem. You know, Germany have put themselves in a situation here where they had an opportunity to really reward themselves for a strong performance. And in the end, they collapsed and sort of, you know, impaired themselves, which is really disappointing. I know that people will say that after they brought off those three players, Sané, Werner and Gnabry, that things went sour. But to be honest with you, if you watch the game, they also had chances after those substitutions were made to kill it off. Thilo Kehrer, if he just passes the ball in the box there, that's a much better opportunity. Timo Werner had a chance before he went off as well to score. There were opportunities for Germany to really end the game and score a third, but they didn't do that. So I'm not sure the subs were entirely to blame, and I don't like this narrative. Thomas Müller was obviously selected to get his 100th cap, and now we've done with this sentimental let's just move on, because he doesn't deserve to be in this squad anymore based on his form. It's obvious. We can respect him for what he's done for the Germany team, but he needs to make strong decisions for the squad going forward. And it was obvious to me last night that Thomas Müller isn't necessarily the right option for the way that this team can play. Look at how devastatingly good those front three players were. The pace and power and the ability of players like Gnabry to just flick the ball and then instinctively know where Werner's going to go. That's the kind of football that Germany need. So don't like that Müller narrative, because I think there were opportunities for Germany to kill the game. But I also don't like the narrative, oh, they had the chance to win the contest. You're 2-0 up. That's enough. You don't need a third goal. You need to be good enough to defend a 2-0 lead at home. So lots of positives, but they were hidden by the last 5 minutes.
I think it was interesting that you said you walked away from the ground, and James as well, saying that everyone's walking away from that game, still with Russia in the head, still with the World Cup in the head. Do you think there could have been a more abrupt and a more noticeable split off immediately after that World Cup, and therefore do you think that's been left too late?
Potentially. I mean, the obvious split up would have been to remove Joachim Löw as head coach, and I think a lot of it comes back to that. The biggest issue for the Germany side was that 5 minutes after the end of the World Cup they said Joachim Löw's our guy. And I think that's the biggest issue for me, because
so before the World Cup, didn't they, as well?
Well, with the contract extension. But you know, when everybody was asking the question, what are you going to do now, they immediately said, well, he's the man to take us forward. Well, that's kind of a strange thing to say, because now they have given themselves no other option but to stay with him until the Euros. He has to be their head coach now. Not only because there's no one else out there and they haven't done their research. That's also hilariously bad planning from the DFB to not put in plans for a successor. How can you not do that? And I think Germany have got fat off their own success.
They almost seem quite in no man's land, I think, actually. I mean, if you look, you only got to look at the lineup last night. Yes, and John's right to point out the positive contributions of Sané, of Gnabry, of Werner, of Kehrer. I think Schultz,
I didn't see the game,
but I believe Schultz had another half-decent performance. That's all well and good. But on the other hand, you've still got an axis of players there built around Neuer, around Kroos, around Hummels. I know we brought on Müller for sentimental reasons.
Well, hold on, can I jump in? Because I wanted to bring up Neuer, because he seems to be the... Of the senior guard, he still seems to be the one that still has a reason to play more than the rest of them. So that's why I think it's interesting to group him with the rest of Hummels, and he's captain,
but he shouldn't be playing because we
said this before the World Cup.
Yeah, Ter Stegen should have played in Russia.
Ter Stegen should have been going based purely on form and consistency alone. Yeah. Obviously, Neuer was injured. Not much he could do about that. But yeah, in terms of form, I think as much you can say that in terms of his quality, Manuel Neuer has a reason to be there. I think in terms of form and consistency, André Ter Stegen, as we said before, the World Cup has an even bigger reason to have been there.
Yeah, and that's the problem. If Löw's going to pick players based on reputation rather than form, then there's a real concern about what kind of message that sends to the squad. You know,
for me, it's taken at least four or five games too many for him to finally be starting.
Why is it taking him so long? That's the problem. It's taken him too long to recognise those three players are the important going forward. And he still hasn't realised that Manuel Neuer can't be the number one now. You know, what he did in 2014, incredible. Revolutionised the way that goalkeeping was being played in the modern era, the way that goalkeeping was being viewed. Absolutely. That's 4 years ago. Stop talking about it. And this is what I mean about Germany getting fat off their success. They got lazy. They thought they could just go into this tournament. Remember what all those guys said before the tournament? Yeah, we're a tournament team. We'll turn it on when we get there. Absolutely ridiculous mentality to have going into a tournament. You're never going to do anything if that's what you think.
Are you talking about the World Cup?
And that's what's so frustrating, because it seems to have carried on this sort of sense of, well, Neuer's there because he's great. Yeah, look, no disrespect. He should probably be in there because he's important. But should he be starting? And that's what we need to talk about here. Löw's banging on about Umbruch, right? The German word for, you know, new start and change. Well, where is it?
Well, didn't it come in this international
break,
though?
You could argue that, but there are still too many blocks, theoretically. Why is Manuel Neuer the number one? Ter Stegen has to be the number one now. You have to make that move. You've got to start justifying things with sporting aspects, because you know what? Last night, he picked three players up front based on performance, and look what happened. They were devastatingly good. That's why you've got to make those decisions more often. You can't keep saying, oh, we're going to pick this guy because he's got 100 caps, or because 4 years ago. Look, squad balance, mentality, character, philosophy, all of those things got to come into play. But at the end of the day, this is a football team and they need to be performing on a football pitch. That's why you've got to start making those decisions. And one of the other things we haven't talked about is Joshua Kimmich. Right, Joshua Kimmich in midfield?
That's going to be my next question. Yeah. Wasted. You saw him last night. What was he like?
He was not good. The problem with Joshua Kimmich in midfield is he is a technical player that has all of the skills to play that position, but he does not have the presence of mind to play that position because he doesn't play it. So many times last night, he had the ball and he would run towards the guy he was going to pass. And then he was next to him, he'd pass it to him. This is a waste of space and time. And he was hesitant. He was so hesitant on the ball sometimes. And he's great at winning the ball back. Sure, you've got that. But Toni Kroos is your distributor. He's the guy to... That's fine. But the other guy there, Kimmich, was just so hesitant. And Löw's got to decide what he wants from that other holding midfielder. And this is where I think he's got to make a couple of changes. I mean, this is from my very humble opinion, but back five, you can drop one of those. Bring Havertz in, so you have someone behind Gnabry, right? Because Havertz is too good to drop. And let's be honest, how fortunate is Joachim Löw that he doesn't even have to talk about Mesut Ozil because Kai Havertz has fallen into his lap. What a stroke of luck. Okay, play Havertz in there. You stay with four at the back rather than five, which is still manageable. You can use those guys as wingbacks if you want. I mean, you've kind of got to if you're going to pick Schultz and Kehrer because they're kind of wingers anyway. And then you have a base with Kroos and another midfielder. If that other midfielder is going to be your guy who's just roaming around, making the tackles and basically adding another dimension to the defence, then pick someone who is literally just there to tackle and clean up. And play Kimmich out wide, really, because he's much better at crossing the ball.
His crossing ability.
And his overlapping
goes
play,
amiss when he's in the middle like that.
And his overlapping play at Bayern is also invaluable, right? And even if you're not going to cross the ball a lot, because they didn't really cross it that much last night, they were much more devastating.
Jags coming out of position.
Yeah, he's so much better out wide. You know, use players in those skill sets. Don't force them into areas. Kimmich can do the tackling, and he can do a bit of that cleanup. But there are better players in the Bundesliga to do that. You know, if you want to have options in that, you know, we're talking about who's going to come in. Sebastian Rudy a year ago was a perfect option in that situation because he can be. He's out of form now, so you can't pick him. So you go through midfield options. I mean, he's probably a little bit new and too fresh, but Florian Neuhaus has really impressed me. Plays for under the 21s. Löw's never going to pick him. He's never going to drop in the deep end like that. But you're looking for a type of player. Christoph Kramer, if he got the game time again, he's real solid. He's not exciting. There's nothing sexy about his football. But all you need in that position is for someone to be unsexy so that Toni Kroos can be in the headlines. That's what you need. You need a little bit more balance in this team. And I think there are still some growing pains. It was obvious last night. Kimmich is one of them. Müller, Neuer. There are still some things to work out. But going forward, those three players, we're not even talking about the fact that Leroy Sané looked like he was wearing blue last night, right? He is playing like the Manchester City winger that Pep Guardiola's going playing. Whatever Löw did in terms of changing the style, that's one thing we've got to give him credit for.
That's what I was going to say, because there were still some positives to take out of this international break, wasn't there? I mean, it did end on a sour note. You can't avoid that. I mean, essentially handing Netherlands the group win with two late goals. But still, I mean, the Germany team has looked lethargic since the start of the World Cup, and or even before that, and one could argue in the entire year. But they didn't look, I wouldn't say they looked lethargic in this international break, have they?
No, I wouldn't say that either. But then again, like I said before, I just think it's all been a little bit too little too late. It's all well and good bringing in a new generation of players and finally blooding them in a meaningless friendly against Russia, and then in an ultimately for Germany meaningless Nations League game against Holland when the damage has already been done. Yeah, positives are there. John's written about them and talked about them, and I think they're clear to see. I wish they'd taken place earlier. Going back to the immediate weeks and months after the World Cup, I said that I had a little bit of understanding for Löw being more conservative and a little bit more wary against France in that first game.
That nil-nil,
afterwards,
right?
Just get beyond that game. Don't get smashed by the world champions at home. Okay, fair enough. But then, yeah, moving on from that, I think, yeah, great. But too little too late. And like I said, still remnants of that old fat axes that John was talking about hanging on. I think, John, you mentioned before how Mats Hummels reacted afterwards towards the press walking through. What was it you said?
I've decided to take a break. Like, I've earned myself a break.
A break of talking to the media.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Talking to the media.
Not like a break from football.
What sort of attitude is that? And I think if that attitude is still hanging around like a bad smell in that dressing room, then it needs moving on ASAP. Whether Joachim Löw is the man to do that, I've still got massive doubts, because he's clearly loyal to those players.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
Perhaps that's inevitable, given what they've all gone through.
But that's the thing. We've got to stop asking the question whether he's the right man, because he's the only man, right? They've left themselves no option now but for him.
Yeah, I think it's quite obvious that he's probably not the right man.
Yeah,
but the DFB have left themselves in a situation here but through pure lack of planning, becoming overcomfortable and, for want of a better word, arrogant. They've definitely between a rock and a hard place now, and for me it's all too little too late, and that's the price
they've got to. This is the thing. Just imagine if Löw had been a little bit braver and he had taken these players to Russia. I'm not saying
he took them to the Confederations Cup. Yeah, the proof is there that they could do it.
And this division there's lots of reports about it. I'm not sure I would say that I saw any concrete evidence that there were two groups in the camp during Russia. I definitely saw an arrogant side generally, but I'm not sure I would say that I saw two different groups. But this loyalty, he's recognised now, a little bit too late, but thank goodness, to be honest, if we're going to have him for the next 2 years, that he's recognised that this is the way that he needs to go. But imagine if Germany had taken Serge Gnabry, had started Julian Brandt, had been a little bit bolder, maybe taken Kai Havertz as well, had realised that Timo Werner's strength was out wide in a front three set, and that they could get, and I'm not, maybe he could have taken Leroy Sané, but that would then have meant that Löw would have had to realise the way to play Sané was in this formation, in this style of play.
Yeah, Draxler's captain anyway.
Draxler as another option who is fit. Imagine all of these players in the system that we saw last night. Germany would have made in the knockouts. I'm absolutely sure of it. And the fact that he wasn't brave enough, and he's admitted, you know, he was trying to get this perfectionism towards this possession-based football. just a little bit frustrating that it's taken him so long, because, you know, we've just, Matt just said, you know, it's a shame that it's come to a three games too late. You can argue it's come 6 months too late. He has waited far too long. And in most professions, if you do something wrong and then write it 6 months later, most people don't get the chance to write it 6 months later because most people are looking for a new job. So he's in a very fortunate position that he has earned because of his previous success and because the DFB haven't done their homework in terms of finding a successor. But he's now got to follow this path. He's got to pursue it. He's got to commit to it. He can't just say, oh, you know, we did that against Holland, so, you know, that worked out. When we get to the games next year, he has got to pick the same young players. He's got to recognise the older players who are not performing, that don't deserve to be in the squad based on performance. He's got to make that shift. And it's got to be dramatic. It has to be dramatic, because you can't half-heartedly go about it. And you can't have press conferences after the game saying, you know, yeah, we're still growing, we're still learning. Yeah, hold on a minute. You spent 6 months doing that. There's enough in this team now, if you pick the right players and you pick the right system, which they did for the most part last night, to get good results and to get Germany playing exciting football again.
How are we going to look at the year of 2018 for Germany 5 years from now?
There's only one way to describe it. It's a massive setback. It's a massive setback and a preventable one for a side that could have looked to all of the other World Cup sides that won nations, that won a tournament, and then in the following tournament, absolutely tanked. And why? Because they thought, in most cases, that the way that they played 4 years ago was going to be enough to carry them through again. And Germany have inexcusably done the same thing in Russia. This is something that, for me, is a stain on Joachim Löw's record as the head coach of Germany. He did great things in 2014, but, you know, let's be honest, he also had the slice of fortune that he needed. Algeria, that was a lucky game. That could have gone the other way. France, they win that 1-0 thanks to a set piece, right?
And an outstanding Manuel Neuer.
Yeah, and an outstanding Manuel Neuer, right? These things need to come together. That's all part of winning a tournament, absolutely. But if they don't come together and then you make the wrong decisions on top of that, it's no surprise that you have such a horrendous tournament. It's a year to forget, but it's also could be one of those years in 5 years where we turn around, a bit like 2000, where we turn around and say, all right, that's where Germany recognized where they went wrong, and that's why they're now one of the best teams in the world. Because in 2000, they were absolutely a rock bottom. They made changes domestically that worked out for them. They can't necessarily make those changes domestically anymore because they're in full fruition. They're blossoming right now. So it's actually up to the coach and the selection of players that he makes. But if we look back in 5 years and say, well, that's where it started, then we're in trouble.
For me, it's been a year of hubris on and off the pitch,
yeah, that's
for Germany,
for
the national team. Yeah, John, you've gone into more than enough detail about the issues on the pitch and how it's all been too slow. I think the word, like, again, repeat the word fat. I think that goes along with hubris really, really well.
Yeah.
But off the pitch as well, there's been a big debate over the past couple of weeks regarding the ticket sales for Germany games.
Atmosphere was terrible last night.
Yeah, as it was in Leipzig. Yeah. There were empty seats over there. I think, was it 35 to between 35 and 40,000 watched the game against Russia, 40,000 last
40,
night in Gelsenkirchen.
Yeah,
the grounds aren't selling out, and there's reasons for that, and there's reasons for that which are also outside the DFB's control, and oversaturation of football, ticket prices, all sorts of things. But a lot of the reasons are of the DFB's own making. This is an organisation which, particularly between 2014 and 2018, but even before that, have focused more attention on building this Nationalmannschaft brand, Die Mannschaft. Oliver Bierhoff has been the driving force behind that. The fan club Nationalmannschaft, sponsored by Coca-Cola, it's just a poor imitation of a fan culture. They seem to have actively tried to imitate a supporter culture whilst driving away precisely those elements which make it. So they've been backing a loser from the start there. They said, Löw, Bierhoff and Reinhard Grindel, the president of the DFB, said in their analysis post-World Cup they want to try and start focusing on going back towards the fans, back towards the grassroots, you know, re-establishing that connection with German supporters and that connection with the national team. They've done that in a purely superficial way and no more. A training session in front of 5,000 kids in Berlin, answering questions from school kids in Leipzig, which turned into a bit of a farce anyway, with journalists sat next to 7-year-old kids and Manuel Neuer then responding like, oh yeah, nice one for asking that question, but I see you've got a journalist sat next to you. And so that turned into farce anyway.
They still haven't understood.
What was it they had last night? A banner before kickoff saying...
Oh, wir kommen wieder, keine Frage. Yeah,
we'll come again, no question. It's a really odd thing, just a really odd banner. And obviously it was sold as having been produced by the fans. No, it hadn't. It had been produced by the fan club, sponsored by Coca-Cola. That wasn't a message from the fans. And then post-match, Marco Reus saying, oh, I was a bit surprised at lack of atmosphere. Well, one...
He's been spoiled in Dortmund.
One, you play for Borussia Dortmund. And two, what do you expect from Germany fans when the organisation you play for has spent 6 or 7 years constructing this absolutely false, fake, plastic fan culture surrounding a football team?
It's funny, last night, though, in the stadium...
What do you expect?
In the stadium, lots of fans last night just talking about, like, when they were supporting, you know, sat within earshot of me, this idea of, you know, returning to a level of expectation that's normal. Germany fans are very, very expectant.
Yeah.
You know, this performance last night, they were like, oh, we're back at status quo now, we're the best in the world. Do you know my eins in der Welt sind wir? Yeah, okay, cool. That's your only chance. That's cool. But there doesn't seem to be much... sort of feeling for development and slow growth from where they were.
It's an expectancy because in my experience, it's a completely different crowd that watches those games at home games. It's not a regular week in, week out Bundesliga crowd. And so, of course, they're expecting.
And they've been submitted to this atmosphere that you just talked about.
And they've been conditioned to turn up for the past 6 years and watch a victory.
So
like me going to the cinema and expecting a happy end.
So
it's going to happen, isn't it? I'll go to the cinema, pay my money, sit there, allow myself to be passively entertained. In the end, the goodies win.
Yeah,
you know, fantastic. But that's not how football works. Yeah. That's what football fans week in, week out understand. That's why there's a passionate fan culture, because you get behind it. But those people who are turning up to watch the games at Germany, this is the audience that they've cultivated for themselves.
And all those real fans.
So then don't go complaining when the atmosphere is crap. Yeah.
So is this also the year, Matt, then, that the German national team visibly lost touch with reality, would you say?
I think they lost touch with reality years ago, but visibly lost touch. And when that really came to fruition and became noticeable among the general public, yeah, certainly. Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's move back to the Bundesliga because we're doing our new favorite segment, which is a spotlight segment where we get to break down one of the Bundesliga teams. You guys voted. Thank you very much for all of you voted for Hertha Berlin. And we thank you because they're actually a very, very interesting club.
I'm really happy that the result has turned out this way. Because, I mean...
I am a donut.
You are?
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
I am a donut.
No, they have interest in it. It's a club that I don't really tend to watch a lot myself. Through pure geographical reasons, obviously we're based over here in Western Germany, and we have our hands
on the other side of the world.
We have our hands full with all the clubs around here. So yeah, Hertha is a nice one for voting that. This is a good one.
All right, so let me give the crash course for this club. I get to do a little bit more than I did the last time because I'm doing one team instead of two. Interestingly enough, they were founded by two sets of brothers in 1892, Fritz and Max Lindner, and Otto and Will Lorenz.
Not easy names. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Round of applause
very German names.
For Davis's pronunciation there. Well done.
Actually, what I find when I switch between like German and English is you really have to switch to get the enunciations right. You really have to switch your brain.
Absolutely.
They were founded as the Berliner Fußball Club Hertha, and the name Hertha was suggested by Fritz Lindner after he and his father rode on a steamboat called Hertha
before the
club's founding.
There you go, look at that.
The club's colors at the time were blue, white, and green because that was the, I guess it's not a smokestack on a steam engine, but it's the chimney of the steam engine.
Was that
the colors of the chimney of the steam engine.
I'll believe him. Good decision to drop the green.
And because those two sets of brothers were teenagers, it's actually their uncle that was the one that registered them with the authorities as a club.
Deep knowledge here on the Tribune Podcast.
It won its first local title in 1906, but lost in the semifinals of the German championship to VfB Leipzig. A club in Leipzig that actually doesn't exist anymore.
The follow-on club is Lokomotive Leipzig.
It merged with the Berliner Sport Club, which was the financially stronger club in 1923. And it actually reached the finals of the German Championship, which at the time was regional first and then a tournament playoff style to the end. They reached the final of that tournament six straight times between 1926 and 1931.
Sounds a bit like Bayern Munich, wow.
But didn't win their first title, actually, until 1930.
So no more like Leverkusen.
So they beat Holstein Kiel in 1930, and then they won the championship again after beating 1860 Munich in 1931.
These classic teams coming out.
Great
here.
Names.
Great names. Forgotten teams of the past.
The club was completely overhauled in the Third Reich in Nazi Germany in 1933, but was disbanded with, like we mentioned with Werder Bremen in the first Spotlight segment, was disbanded like many other clubs at the time. Any organizations at the time were disbanded, but it was reformed in 1945 as SG Gesundbrunnen, which is it's a Stadtteil, it's a neighborhood.
It's the region there.
So it was refounded in 1945 as SG Gesundbrunnen, and then reclaimed its Hertha identity in 1949, so 40 years later. In the 1950s, it had a really strong rivalry with Tennis Borussia Berlin. And actually almost merged there were plans to merge the two clubs in 1958, but only three of the 260 members at the time, or 66 members, I think it was, actually voted in favor of the two clubs merging together. The fan base was physically divided after the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961, making it impossible for their fans in East Germany at the time to see the games. Although their stadium at the time in Gesundbrunnen was right next to the Berlin Wall, so
I bet that'd be a great documentary.
There were some fans that would go up to the Berlin Wall and would still cheer when Hertha scored.
There's some good old footage of the old stadium Gesundbrunnen. I think it was known as Die Plumpe.
Yeah, exactly.
The name of the old ground. It's not there anymore, but yeah.
Wow.
So they became a founding member of the Bundesliga in 1963 and have spent 35 seasons, including this season, in the Bundesliga. They have not won actually any major domestic titles since World War II, but they have been five-time winner of the Intertoto Cup.
Oh, the legendary Intertoto.
And won the Liga Pokal in 2001 and 2002.
World's most complicated and pointless trophy. Love it.
They did make two finals in the German Cup since they entered the Bundesliga, but it's actually the major story is that their reserve team made it to the German Cup final in 1993 before losing to Leverkusen.
One of the great stories.
Yeah, Love that one.
And that was in the Olympiastadion, but when they had started playing the German Cup final in the Olympiastadion in 1985, so that was also in the Olympiastadion.
A bit of an irony and a bit of a trauma, I think, for Hertha Berlin that this is their constant dream to make it to a DFB Cup final
at home
in their own stadium. This is their dream, and they've never done it.
But the reserve team managed.
The reserve team managed it.
So there were actually there was plans of another major merger called FC Utopia in Berlin. It was a merger between Tennis Borussia Berlin, the Spielvereinigung Blau-Weiß 1890 Berlin, and
I love German football names.
ABC 123 Spielfeld Fußball Ecke Freistoß.
And the third team was the fourth team actually was SSC Berlin in 1982, but those plans never came to fruition.
FC Utopia. That sounds like a startup in Berlin. Goodness me.
Their football department was outsourced in 2000, although they did not have an investor invest into the club until 2014, which was an American firm called Colbert Kravis Roberts. Colbert Kravis Roberts currently owns, or KKR or KKR, owned 9.7% at the time. They bought 9.7%, but that can advance up to 33%. And to bring this whole crash course full circle, the Steamboat still exists. Which what the club was named after. It was the club actually fundraised and bought it and restored it for 400,000 euros.
Wow.
And in anticipation of their 125th anniversary in 2017. So it still exists. They're currently in eighth place in the Bundesliga table. And they, after playing, they played their most recent season in Europe was in the Europa League last year. Yeah, so let's just talk about what's going on this season for the club.
Yeah, well done, Davis. Enjoyed the Hearth Berlin crash club. Love that. We'll have to get you a trip on the Hearth, a steam cruiser. Yeah.
Next up for all the listeners, we need a photo of Davis on the steam cruiser.
We'll get Davis on that.
So yeah, so let's talk about this season because they're actually, I don't think a lot of people recognize this, but they are one of the youngest teams in the Bundesliga currently. They've sold some of their best veteran players, John Anthony Brooks and some others in recent season. Of course, Mitchell Weiser also was the major transfer last season that went to Bayer Leverkusen.
Ibisevic and Kalou are still there, dragging that age up.
Ironically, even though they're a young team, they still rely on some of the more veteran players. Davy Selke was one of their major acquisitions in recent seasons, hasn't gotten into much of the starting lineup as much this season. So what do you think that of their performance so far this season? Obviously not playing in Europe this season last season.
This season, we're not even halfway through yet, but it's already been, they've had like two mini seasons, haven't they?
Yeah, right.
I think in the first six games, they ended up third. I think after six games, we went third in the Bundesliga, including that 2-0 win against Bayern Munich. Really impressive performance, but they've not won in the league since then, have they? So I think,
but they drew with Dortmund.
With Dortmund, but they've not actually won a game since that victory over Bayern Munich. Yeah. And I think if you look at the table, purely limited to match day 7 to match day 11, which was the last one we had, I think Hertha are 15th. So yeah, a lot of draws and combined 7-1 last two games against Red Bull, and then 4-1 against Dusseldorf. Although they only had 10 men for that. So yeah, it's they've certainly lost a bit of that. Pardad has put it down to a lack of aggression and grit in midfield mainly, that they've. Yeah, this high pressing game they had going on, in which was destabilising teams so much in the first six games, they seem to have lost that a little bit. I thought they recovered that really, really well in the second half against Dortmund. We discussed that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that was a good game.
But perhaps the signs were there to be seen there in that game, in that they weren't able to keep up that high pressure for 90 minutes. Then again, maybe it wasn't the plan either. I did say, we're not going to Dortmund to play nice football. We're going there to grind out a win however we can. They got that in the last minute. But yeah, I think the warning signs were probably there. They have had issues with injuries, especially at the back. So yeah, I think Dardai said last week after the thrashing by Dusseldorf that it's time to go back to basics.
Yeah, I think if you lose to Dusseldorf as well, I know they had a man sent off, but that's a side that shouldn't really be in the division quality-wise.
Right.
So you got to ask some serious questions at that point. Yeah. We're speaking nice like overlap unintentionally. Dilrussen played last night for the Netherlands. I think he made his debut.
Yeah.
But got injured. So Pau Dardai, I think I read today in Kicker, was pretty furious because he's already got quite a lot of injuries to deal with, and Dilrussen's been pretty good for them this season.
Yeah, so a strong addition for them.
Yeah,
for
really
sure.
Strong. I wasn't expecting him to be so good and hit the ground running, but I think it's difficult for sides like Hertha because you, without those key players, especially in key positions, if you have a couple of injuries, you can really struggle. I think when they have everyone fit and available, I think they're a completely different side.
Well, we talked about it a little bit last season when they were in the Europa League. They basically were just trying to make it through the group stage. They didn't make it out of the group stage.
Didn't he play just young players, though?
He pretty much played a reserve team in those games. The aim wasn't even to try and get out of that group. I've always maintained was the absolute right way to go about it for a club of that stature and for a squad of that size.
Well, that's the point I was going to make, was that Hertha is just not one of the deepest teams in the Bundesliga, and haven't really been since they returned from this period of going up and down in the first and second divisions.
It's not a problem unique to Hertha, is it?
Frankfurt, you can make the same.
Yeah, Cologne, Gladbach in recent
but
years.
Even Frankfurt does have like some depth.
Yeah,
like,
not really. I mean, if you took out Haller and Jovic,
I think Frankfurt have absolutely surpassed all expectations this season in Europe. But we'll get on to them another time. Hertha, I think one of the questions we got in before, I think, just puts nail on the head. Like, why have hurt and never been able to really establish themselves as a club who can continually compete at the top. And I think that question can quite fairly be levelled at any Bundesliga top half club apart from Dortmund and Bayern. Maybe Schalke in brackets.
Maybe Leverkusen too, I was going to say too. Because with their resources at the very least.
So yeah, and yeah, like you said, Davis, the squad depth isn't necessarily there with Hertha. They suffer just like other clubs of having losing some of their best performers. The latest example being Mitchell Weiser, although it certainly helped that Andre Duda has finally, after 2 years of injury and bad luck,
suddenly
and bad performances, has finally
arrived,
rocketed into life this season. He's been fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that also I think that Hertha is not as known for as other clubs is that they're actually really good at developing young players.
Yeah, that's true. They have great youth players. Yeah.
You mentioned Del Rosen before. Yeah. Andres Duda, only 23, was played really well actually for Slovakia in the under 21 tournament a few years ago. And
it was playing Slovakia. That's where Dardai saw him. Dardai was actually at the game against England in Saint Etienne in Euro 2016, wasn't it? I think
a good shout.
Yes, yeah, must be. He was at that game. That's where we saw Duda playing against England, and I think despite it being 0-0, he said, this is the perfect number 10 that we need. It just took him a while. He had a bad injury as well, but it took him a while to actually establish himself in Berlin.
But look at the young. I mean, you've got Jonathan Klinsmann there now, who's supposed to be impressing at youth level. You know, they've got
Max Mittelstedt even impressing already. Playing in a starting role.
And the best example I think is Arne Meyer. Arne Meyer is a phenomenal defensive midfielder for his age, and his lack of experience, but he's just come out of nowhere.
Paul Dardai's own son is
what's
in
it? Palco?
Palco?
Yeah.
Palco?
You get players like that just seamlessly transition into first team football, and that's a huge credit to Hertha. I mean, you've got two ways to approach it as a club. You realise that if Augsburg can buy or sell a player for 30 million, then you've got to do something different if you can't compete with that amount of money. And that's why I think the sales of Brooks and Weiser were smart ones, because the sale of Brooks was, he was like, what, 20 million or something? You got to snap the hand off of that. I mean, he's good, but take that money, invest it, bring those young players through, because you're not going to compete otherwise.
I'm not sure how directly the Brooks and Weiser money was directly reinvested into some of the transfers they have made. Obviously, Duda was definitely before that, but for me, the side bringing Davy Selke in, despite his injuries, that's been absolutely key for me. Yeah. I mean, he's just getting back to form now.
Right.
Obviously, it was him that brought about the penalty in the last minute against Dortmund. It was him that got the consolation goal away at Dusseldorf. Really good solo run, demonstrating control, strength, a good finish. Really, really impressive play for me, and I think complements what they have in Kalou and Ibisevic. I think Selke complements them two really, really well.
He's going to have a tough job though, because he's going to have to transition this side forward, because Ibisevic and Kalou are not getting any younger, and he's going to have to find ways to replace that experience and that quality going forward. He doesn't necessarily have the greatest amount of money to spend, but he's got to find a way to move Hertha forward. Right, we're in the Europa League last year. We just said, group stage didn't necessarily impress, but that's fine. You just take the experience. But, if Hertha are going to kick on here, they need to be a top 10 regular. They don't need to have any of these dips. And that's why this Dusseldorf performance is a real concern for me, because it's a turning point. Is this the point where Hertha get stuck in the mud and they can't recover from the fact that they lost to a terrible side? Or are they going to be able to turn it around and kick on and be the top 10 side that they can be? This is a big challenge for him, because eventually this squad's going to have to change moving forward.
Well, I think we also need to kind of set the expectations for them, because as I mentioned briefly, that I mean they were a what they
bit
say
of
in
a
Germany
yo-yo.
A Schalke-Stuhl-Verein.
Yeah, but a yo-yo team.
Or no, it's not what do they say? What's not a Schalke-Verein?
Ein Aufzugsverein.
Yeah. Aufzugs. So an elevator team. Yeah, elevator team. But basically going up and down in the first two divisions, and it wasn't until recently that they really establish themselves kind of as a mid-table team, even as a European.
Yeah, but you're in that stage now where Hertha are starting. They have the opportunity, I think, to kick on. Like, that's what you've got to aim for. You take that experience.
Yeah,
of
been back
league.
In the Bundesliga since 2013 now.
Five seasons.
Right.
It's time to solidify that spot in the top 10, and then in the next two or three years, start to say to yourself, well, in the next two or three seasons, we've got to try and break the top six.
Because they are in a unique position, which brings positives and negatives, and we'll get onto this in a second, won't we? I think with the whole identity and fan culture around Hertha Berlin, but they are in the capital of the capital city of the country, which is the motor behind European economics and politics.
Well,
and
one
all
most,
sorts.
Probably the most one, important one,
one
country in Europe.
Yeah, one of the most important, one of the biggest cities in the world. I think 5.9 or 6 million population, Berlin. But it brings with it its own very unique contradictions. But the potential for a football, a Bundesliga club, a top flight club in the Bundesliga
in
the capital city, the size and importance of Berlin, there's huge potential. You just question sometimes whether that's really, really being exploited enough.
Mm. Well, I also wonder how much investment they've been able to get, because they did get one investor a few years ago, but I mean they outsourced their club. I mean, almost two decades ago. And yet, I mean, there have been senior members of the club that have gone to China in recent years to try to get investment there. And you also see, I mean, Leipzig is not very far away. And one of the impacts that RB Leipzig has had was that some people feared that it would take attention away from Hertha Berlin because the club is not really that far away.
I'm not sure if I agree. I'm not sure if that was ever
I've heard that argument before. But
no, it's not an argument. It's not an argument I've heard. And
but one of the things you wonder is just how much in a capital city, how much interest they can, not only get from a supporter level, but how much interest they can get from people that could hypothetically invest.
But
that's
exactly why I think the question has to be asked at Hertha, and it is one of the answers to that question: why have they been unable to establish themselves? I think one of the answers to that has to be to question, well, yeah, given the potentials on your doorstep in that city, look at the club leadership, the club hierarchy. Why has not enough been done to attract the sponsorship, to build a club which is attractive to sponsors, attractive to supporters, attractive to top players? Because you would think all the ingredients are there.
Is there something to be made about the fact that Lucien Favre, when he was there, got them playing really attractive football? And obviously they were in the Champions League, but the work done by Hoeneß's brother was really detrimental to the club in terms of messing the finances and driving that down. Like, is there something to be made about the fact they've been burnt a bit once and now they're a bit hesitant? Not hesitant, but don't want to get burned again, because obviously that can really affect the side. Because they were in the Champions League. What was this like? I don't know.
2010.
I think there's definitely an argument to suggest that there's maybe a little bit of hesitance around Hertha. I was speaking to one of their hardcore supporters a couple of years ago around the subject of their outsourcing and investment in Hertha Berlin. And they're sort of split in terms of like the KKR investment. On the one hand, it's like, yeah, great. They invest. They don't control too much equity in the club. They don't tend to get involved with the day-to-day running. But on the other hand, they've got a huge portfolio of a history of investment in Germany, none of which is particularly long-term. So I think there is perhaps a hesitance around Hertha to really take that next step if they're not entirely 100% convinced that the money backing them is there for the long term, because we all know there's enough disastrous examples of clubs in German football who have lost investment and struggled.
Kaiserslautern,
Braunschweig, 1860 Munich, the whole lot.
Well, we mentioned this briefly. I think it's a good time to get on it now, because just the history of Berlin in general and the history of the fan culture also kind of It's still very ever-present today. So, Matt, I mean, you're the supporter, do you want to get into that?
Like I said, completely unique in any German city, but in the world. I mean, not many cities in human history have been split for 30 years the way Berlin was. Like you said in that introduction before, Davis, there was the physical issue of East Berliners being unable to watch Hertha Berlin after 1961. You were simply not allowed to go. Before that, in the years between 1945 and the building of the wall, Hertha actually actively tried to attract fans from the eastern sector of Berlin before the wall went up with cheaper tickets to account for their lower wages. And during the split, the period where Berlin was divided, there's actually it seems bizarre now, but there's actually a friendship between Hertha Berlin fans and Union Berlin fans in the East. They would actually often visit each other clandestinely. Usually Hertha fans go in the other way to the East because they were allowed to go back, whereas East Berliners would not be allowed to go to the West because they wouldn't come back. but obviously nowadays, I think, if you ask an older generation of Hertha fans, they'd probably acknowledge that friendship with Union. among the younger fans. No, I don't think they like each other at all. But yeah, so but I think that split and the effect it had has had longer reaching consequences for Berlin in terms of the support. After the unification, when the whole of Berlin was then opened up to the rest of Germany again, Berlin is quite famous in Germany as being a city where not many Berliners actually live. A lot of Berliners moved away, and a lot of people from elsewhere, particularly Stuttgart and the southwest, moved to Berlin to take advantage of the new business opportunities. I think also for a period, if you moved to Berlin, you could avoid military service as well.
If you had a and you're given job benefits.
If you had a Berlin address. There were all sorts of economic benefits of moving to Berlin. But it also meant that these people moved to Berlin but kept their old club. So you've got huge support in Berlin for Schalke, for Stuttgart, for Cologne, for Hamburg, for St. Pauli, Dortmund, Bayern, you name it. But yeah, these people have not moved to Berlin, but then adopted Hertha Berlin as their team. So yeah, that's an issue. Perhaps a little bit harsh on Hertha, because there's not much they could do about that. They often have that accusation levelled at them that the ground is always empty, apart from those two occasions per year when Dortmund and Bayern come to town. And the cup final, a third one, which they're never in. but having said that, the ground looks empty, but that's only because it has a capacity of 75,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Which only the Westfalenstadion is bigger. In fact, they average about 45,000 Hertha, which is pretty much normal in the Bundesliga. Just looks worse because the ground's so big. Yeah. And that's another thing we might get onto, that they do want to build a new ground, don't they? They want to build a new ground.
Have their own identity. And
A proper football stadium, so they don't have the running track.
Yeah, 2025, right?
That's 2025 is the plan. They want to start building it in January 2022.
Where? In Berlin?
Right next to the Olympic Stadium. The discussions were about building a new ground outside in the state of Brandenburg, which is the state outside the city of Berlin. Which obviously
wasn't popular
because they saw themselves as a club in the heart of Berlin, Berlin's club. So why are you building a ground out in the state of Brandenburg? Where the clubs in Brandenburg will be Energie Cottbus, I suppose, one of the biggest clubs there in that state. Now the decision has been made to build a ground right next to the Olympic Stadium. But obviously it still needs to be ticked off by the Berlin Senate.
You have to also point out that it is an Olympic park, so there's still a lot of infrastructure around.
And that infrastructure was revamped at huge cost to the public purse ahead of 2006. Yeah. So the question is, the Berlin City Council still owns the ground, and they obviously don't necessarily want Hertha to move out, because the question then is, who's going to use expensively revamped stadium after they move out?
And then the cost of holding that for one year, just every year for the cup final.
Yeah.
Well, they do have track and field events there. Yeah. They do have
concerts.
Have concerts there too. It's not like it wouldn't go out of use, but having a tenant there that uses the ground every weekend or twice a week.
Well, it's a shame, but there seems to be the feeling in Berlin, especially among Hertha fans, that the Senate are almost shooting themselves in the foot, and they don't. The Olympic Stadium, because of its historic importance, is a protected heritage site. A few years ago, I was told this by a journalist in Berlin a few years ago, that they actually tried to build more toilets at the Olympic Stadium, and even that wasn't allowed.
Wow.
They weren't granted planning permission to build new toilets.
It's when something gets that historical landmark, it's really difficult to change anything.
It is an incredible building. The circumstances surrounding its building are obviously dubious. It was built by the Nazis.
Yeah.
That
is a history that Germany recognizes. Yeah.
So. You can't avoid it. Yeah, it was there, and it is, regardless of who built it, it's still an incredible piece of architecture.
Right. From the outside, it doesn't look big, and then you get inside, and it's huge.
It is incredible. Like,
it is almost a modern day Colosseum.
But it is a frustration for a lot of Hertha fans. I think that a lot of them complain about the running track, which means that a lot of the fans are a good 20 meters away from the pitch, but they can't move.
We had it at the Wythene; it was fine.
Exactly, but that's the counter argument. Yeah. Obviously, that was a classic case in old British grounds and a lot of old German grounds, Dusseldorf, Cologne, Bayern at the Olympic
Stadium. Look at Rotterdam.
Dortmund's old ground. Loads of grounds in Germany were multi-purpose and had running tracks.
Well, because they were sports clubs.
Yeah, exactly. The sports clubs had other departments, and that was never an issue. So, and even the ultras themselves in Berlin, they don't necessarily seem to consider the running track as an issue, but yeah, from a purely aesthetic and general fan experience, it would surely be beneficial to allow them to just restructure the Olympic Stadium, but it's not allowed.
So we went into this a few weeks ago, but the biggest incident with Hertha fans recently was their clash in Dortmund with Dortmund police. There have also been a decent amount of fallout after that. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of people in support of Hertha fans at games that have taken place since then. But the club has taken a very, very different stance to the incident that occurred in Dortmund.
I'm surprised how badly they got it wrong as well. Like,
there's certainly been a feeling among supporters that the club have misjudged this, and they came out very, very quickly with the usual platitudes of condemning the fans, we distance ourselves, nothing to do with us, blah, 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 blah. However, yeah, like I said, there's definitely evidence to suggest that the actions of the police on that day were over the top, and we discussed that a couple of weeks ago. However, since then,
I do want to make clear again. I mean, we said this a few weeks ago. I mean, we do not condone on this podcast fans breaking toilets and that
has come to light regarding that, which I'll get onto in a sec. But in the immediate aftermath of that, the next home game against Red Bull, wasn't it? Hertha banned banners. And flags from the stadium, and in turn the Hertha ultras carried out an atmosphere boycott, so there's no atmosphere at the ground,
which isn't saying much.
let's not be harsh on Hertha fans. There was less atmosphere than usual, and then it's also come out today in Kicker. John, you mentioned it before that it's come out today that apparently before that game against Red Bull, the general manager of Hertha, Michael Preetz, who's also the top scorer, I think, record top scorer at Hertha,
could be,
maybe wrong. He's now general manager. Actually, went into the dressing room and actually tried during the week building up to get the players and the coaching staff to engage in a sort of show of solidarity with the club leadership and against the supporters, who have also spent a lot of time in recent years campaigning against or criticising the club digitalisation and social media strategy.
Well, I was thinking they also had that strain. I say the word strained. Sorry, that's a much more biased word that I'm using. But it was out of the ordinary incident where they did the take of knee.
I forgot about that. Yeah, but that also attracted me, as laudable as the idea behind it is. It also attracted a lot of negative attention. Saying, why on earth do you feel the need to do that?
Was it
just a marketing gig?
Yeah, but not every marketing gig is a bad gig.
Yeah.
Like, if it is, then I think there are much worse things than you can do. You know, if they're trying to show solidarity with someone, then that's something definitely we should be.
But I think we said at the time that, I mean, the first thing that the social media manager said afterwards was mentioning
how many clicks he got off poor communication from him.
Yeah. But on that sort of pure poor communication, there's definitely that issue within Hertha Berlin at the moment, in that the fan scene finds itself at odds with the club leadership because they don't agree on strategy. Hertha are trying to develop an identity which they haven't had, as for the reasons we discussed, haven't had for years. And they don't seem entirely sure what they are either. They try to brand themselves as a startup, fitting into this new startup Berlin identity, but it doesn't seem to be working. And the evidence that's not working is the amount of new PR slogans they have to come up with. They had the classic "We try, we fail, we win," which is an absolutely bizarre John's face.
I can't.
doesn't come across on podcast. The other one was the future belongs to Berlin, but then they ditched that. The current one is in Berlin. You can be anything, even a Hertha fan, which doesn't necessarily paint the best picture of your club. It's like, yeah, you can even be a Hertha fan if you really want. So the club have tried all this. They've got one of the most active social media departments in German football, a big digitalisation, globalisation push, which is all well and good, but don't forget who your support is, and that's the issue that the club's fans have had. Stop focusing on
that's an issue that a lot of clubs in Germany have had, actually.
I think more so in Berlin, and this issue then with them banning the flags after the incidents in Dortmund, that was just the latest issue in this battle between the club's fans and the club leadership.
Michael Pritz, top goal scorer in the history of Hertha Berlin, 108 goals.
That is research on the Tribune podcast.
Live research.
But obviously, yeah, it turns out after Preet then tried to, even before the game, in the dressing room before the Red Bull game, tried to get the players to show a display of solidarity with the digitalisation manager, a fella called, is it Peter or Phil Keuter? Peter. Powell.
One of the P's.
So it begins with P anyway. the players refused, saying on the one hand, no, we don't want to drive a wedge between us and the support.
Yeah.
And we won't let ourselves be instrumentalised. And two, it's 5 minutes to kick off.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
Yeah, trying to mentally prepare for this game.
So that was completely, that was out of order as well. So yeah, the battle between the active fan scene in Berlin and the club goes on. The other issue, which I said has come to light since the incidents in Dortmund, was the presence, and this was down to research by WDR, which is the public broadcaster over here, the presence of one particular hooligan group at Hertha Berlin who were involved specifically in the incidents beneath the away end in Dortmund. So these were the lads who were allegedly throwing bits of broken off door and toilet and all sorts of stuff and flares at the police. A group called Caliber 030, which I think is based off the dialing code, I think, for Berlin.
Yes, yeah. Well, that is the dialing code.
Yeah, and the links to the group in Dortmund, which was broken last year, Riot 0231.
I think I have to give Matt Detective Ford from
that was also the based on the Dortmund dialing code. There were links between them, and there are similarities between the groups in that they bring together, hooligans who are certainly intent on looking for violence, want to look for violence, have links to the MMA, mixed martial arts scene, links to the criminal underground and mafia system in Berlin. We talk about fan culture and ultra culture. This is a separate issue altogether. This is hooligan culture. That's probably the area of football cultures we probably don't want. These are certainly people whose first priorities is not their football team. Yeah. So yeah, that's an issue. And yeah, they've come to light. They also came to light during a friendly that Hertha played during the last international break. Hertha played a friendly against Babelsberg, who are Division 4 side.
Mm-hmm. They've got their own history about it.
In nearby Potsdam. You have obviously quite a quite openly left-wing club, quite openly, actively engaged in fights against anti-racism. Against fascism. Yeah, the Nazis, Rauswaffenstadion campaign came from Babelsberg. When Hertha played them, this group, Caliber, these Hertha Berlin hooligans, targeted a Babelsberg pub, smashing doors and windows and attacking the occupants, which was definitely a politically motivated attack rather than a football-related attack. Whether that makes one of them okay, I don't know. Probably not. Mm. But yeah, this is an issue that Hertha also have within their fan scene as well.
Yeah. So to kind of wrap this all up, the one question I wanted to ask before we get out of here is, we have talked about it a little bit about how Hertha struggles with its identity and how if you look at major capitals throughout Europe, Hertha is relatively one of the weaker sides that is based in the country's capital. Mm-hmm. Do we see a future where they could be one of the biggest sides in Germany based on the fact that they are in a capital?
I think that their history is too unique to allow them to be someone like Real Madrid or Arsenal or Paris Saint-Germain. Because I mean, there's, you can look at it both ways. I mean, you guys have given a great set of arguments for both sides and all the historical evidence. But I just think this period of time where they were an island in their own city and now the clear division between East and West, which even if you've been to Germany in the last year or in the last 5 years even, I think it's quite obvious that East-West divide still exists in the country as well as in Berlin. I think that's a unique environment that makes their challenge so much harder than it would do for another side in another capital who doesn't have that historical baggage. And
on the other hand, if you look at it from a, you can take the same argument but spin it more positively.
You can,
and say that for every year, every month and every year that passes, it's another year that Berlin has been united as one city. Yeah. We get further and further and further away from the split Berlin. And if, that brings with it a potential which Hertha Berlin as a Bundesliga side, as a club, as an established club, so it's an advantage that that their rivals
Union
don't
have. Yeah, but
what happens
when Union get
yet.
Promoted?
Yeah, good question. But I mean, Union focus themselves very much as part of their identity is a club from Köpenick.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not, they don't see themselves as the club from Berlin. See themselves as the club from a particular part of Berlin. And that's great. That brings with it its own fantastic fan culture and its own identity.
Because it could still be a Berlin derby, of course.
And there's a big interview in Kicker a couple of weeks ago where I think the general manager of Union was saying that, that's what the city needs. And even I think some of the...
That would help.
Some Hertha representatives were saying it would do us good to have Union back in the Bundesliga. They want a derby.
Want something special.
Yeah, because it would focus the football attention on Berlin. But I think even without... Yes, that would be great for Berlin, and I'd love to see it. It'd be great
Absolutely.
For all the fans. It would be fantastic. But I actually think Hertha, the potential is there for them to do it even without Union. And the potential really is there, the longer it goes on. The potential in that city, they just have to... Yeah, they have to use that potential, get the most out of it. It's definitely there.
All right, that'll do it for this week's, though. Thank you again for contributing to our Spotlight segment. We hope that you enjoy it because we certainly love doing it. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you do, leave us a friendly review. It actually helps us build our reputation in the show. You can also follow us on Twitter at Tribuna Podcast. And be sure to look out for our Shot from the Tribuna poll so you can control what we talk about on the show. Matt Ford is on Twitter at Matt_4D, Jonathan Harding at JohnBlog66, 2 G's and 2 6's, and I'm at Davis_Finopcook. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.